On the weekend panel today, Bridget Morton, a lawyer with Franks Ogilvie and a former senior ministerial advisor to the Minister of Education in the previous national government. And Sam Stubbs, Managing Director of Simplicity, KiwiSaver. He's been the CEO of Tower Investments as well and spent 10 years working for Goldman Sachs in London and Hong Kong. Kia ora korowa and welcome, Sam.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. And hello, Bridget.
Morena.
To start with, as always, a highlight or low light from the past week from each of you. Bridget, do you want to do the honours?
Well, a highlight for me and a bit of a personal highlight, but a lesson for everyone that I spent last weekend in Wanaka with some friends, touring all through the wineries. Absolutely fantastic. Massive highlight, but also just a reminder that, you know, whilst the Trans-Tasman bubble is open, they're still struggling down there, so it's a perfect time, I think, for everyone to get out and get a holiday.
You doing midwinter break, were you?
I like to have multiple winter breaks, so a couple of long weekends always works for me.
It'd be nice if you can have them. Very good. How about you, Sam? What have you been thinking about?
Look, I think this is a very sort of personal thing. We were just made a default KiwiSaver provider this week, so that's a huge deal. We set up the business around our kitchen table 5 years ago, so that was fantastic.
Yeah. All right, thanks for that. Let's start the discussion proper with Prince William.
It brings indescribable sadness to know that the BBC's failures contributed significantly to her fear, paranoia and isolation that I remember from those final years with her.
With his mother. Can you believe, Sam, what Martin Bashir did and what the BBC then did, to put it simply?
Look, sadly I can for Martin in the sense that if you have a media world where journalists get to be personalities and you know you get a brand name, if you get the opportunity to have the ultimate interview, and it's probably the biggest interview of my lifetime, you must be tempted to do things. So his personal behaviour is sad but understandable. The BBC's, however, is that's looking very, very ropey indeed, isn't it? This is an organisation which is funded by public money, which is supposed to, you know, hold everybody, including itself, to the highest standards. So I think that's extremely embarrassing for them, yeah.
Yeah, and of course he was trying to make himself, he wasn't very well known at that stage, Martin Bashir, he was trying to make himself a personality, and Lord Hall, who ran that first review, I see he's resigned from the art job this morning. Bridget, what do you make of this?
I think it's what sort of Sam touched on there, that it's a cultural issue. You know, if you've got one journalist here, but then, you know, an inquiry that didn't even really get to the depths of it. If you've got people acting like this on such high-profile interviews, what's happening down at sort of the grassroots with the sort of integrity and quality of standards that you're setting?
Yeah, well, what's the answer to that? I mean, it's a very complicated situation you're describing. I mean, it seems to people looking in to an organisation like that that it's difficult to believe the sequence of events.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever any easy answer to setting a culture in any kind of company or organisation. But obviously leadership from the top is a key part of that. And if the sort of high profile, you know, you can get away with this type of behaviour, it's setting the standard at the lower levels that this is acceptable.
Budget reaction, please, in brief, because there's already been a lot. But your reactions to the budget. Bridget, do you want to start us off on this one?
Well, I've spent a lot of time talking about the budget this week, being the sort of political geek that I am. But I think the big concern for me is here that there was huge amounts of money being spent, a lot of them in areas where we do need to spend the money, but not a lot of detail about how they're going to spend it and where they're going to get results for that money spend.
Sam?
Look, it felt to me like Labour was going back to its base with this budget, so it was handing out a lot of cash. It was going to the areas where I think it really needed to. This K-shaped recovery that we've had post-COVID has meant, you know, the rich have got richer, the poor have got the picture. So we really needed to get money down where it was being spent. That's also, of course, a very effective way to spend money because it just goes into people's pockets. But I share Bridget's concern there that, you know, you've got a whole lot of money going into government departments there with no specific agenda as to how it's going to be spent.
Well, you've got to trust the spenders, don't you? You've got to trust the expertise in the government departments, again, to keep it simple.
You do, but there are many, many billions of dollars going into many, many very, very, you know, big thinking schemes here. And it's, I think the public service feels to me like it's getting somewhat constrained in its capacity to actually meaningfully spend this money over a period of time, just huge lumps of money going in and saying, look, here it is, spend it, this is the policy. You know, in Wellington, what I hear right now is that there's this phrase, policy is a thin blanket, right? You know, you can make these big statements, you can hand out these big lumps of money, but how are you actually going to meaningfully spend it?
Well, we won't know how meaningful the spend is, will we, until we see how meaningful the results are. Let's talk about a couple of specifics. The extra $200 million to Pharmac, it'll help 370,000 patients a year, said Andrew Little. And it will continue, because it's not enough, in the opinion of some, to consign people, often children, with rare conditions to death, essentially, said Malcolm Mulholland from Patient Voice of Aotearoa.
You know, spend a day with me. I'll take you into the homes of these people that are crying out for drugs. It's all very well to spend money on roads and increase benefits, all of which I'm sure are well-deserving, but you tell me in your priority list, where does the right to live rank?
And there was a television feature I noticed last night on, again, on Trikafta. Where does the right to live, Sam, rank among what's being spent in the budget?
Well, of course, very high. You know, governments and Pharmac exists to keep as many people alive for as long as possible. You know, look, Pharmac's one of the great institutions in New Zealand. It's fantastic, but it's also a bottomless pit of demand. You will never satisfy it. I mean, I think the government's being a bit disingenuous in saying, look, they've increased Pharmac funding by about 23% since they've got into power. That's only 6 or 7% per year compounding. So that's okay, but it's not great. I don't think this is a debate that will ever go away. You're always going to have people wanting to get, you know, cutting edge but very expensive drugs. Can we afford it as a country? The answer is sort of. You know, if we get richer, we can afford more. But so it's a very, very complex issue. It involves really complex decisions and a lot of emotion all the time.
And Bridget, you can always look at it fiscally, but then you look at it from the point of view of families, and it's a totally different matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Malcolm's an amazing advocate for, you know, the space that he's in. But I don't think you can say that Pharmac is the only body that is dealing with people's right to live. There is no doubt that there will be people that will be healthier and, you know, better off in the long term because they've got more money in their back pocket from this budget. Or, you know, people, you know, having safer roads will save lives. You know, so you've got to be a little bit careful here that just because the closeness between the sort of causation and result at Pharmac is much closer than you would at, you know, a social welfare kind of level, that you can't say that this is the most deserving area of spending. It's a really, really difficult and complex set of values to kind of apply across your fiscal books.
$380 million for Māori to build warm, dry houses. As for the rest of our houses, there is the confident assumption now that house prices will stall. Sam, do you agree with that?
Look, Jim, if I get this wrong, my partner's going to remind me of it incessantly. Look, I think, you know, ultimately, if you look at houses are like any other commodity. And if you look at any commodity, demand is an issue for sure. But the really big price movements and whether they stay stable depends on supply. So generally with housing in New Zealand, and there's some confusing numbers out there, but generally I think you can come to the conclusion that unless supply dramatically increases, you're going to continue to see price pressure on the upside for houses. There's no doubt that the government have, as it were, taken some of the heat out of the market with some of these tax offset rules, bright line tests being extended and so on. The investors have certainly cooled off for a while. But until you get more houses built, you're simply not going to get a major downward price pressure in houses. History tells us that, you know, even when that does happen, house prices typically don't drop more than about 5% before they stabilise and recover again. So we'll see. It's hard to know, but certainly very difficult to imagine them carrying on rising at the price they have. I mean, there's just some crazy, crazy prices out there right now.
Crazy, crazy prices. Yes, Geoffrey Halley was opining earlier this morning that, in fact, if the New Zealand housing market does go flat, it tends to go sideways rather than down. Bridget, how are you seeing this?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a supply issue. And what concerns me about the budget this week is that there was more money, but not actually addressing those supplies. So, you know, we've got low unemployment. We don't have a plan for, you know, getting more skilled migration in to actually build some of this housing and the infrastructure that needs to go around the housing. And then, you know, cost of materials. We've still got massively disrupted global supply chains at the moment. You know, the cost is so high here of getting the materials and they're so delayed. And we don't have any movement around that. So in some ways, what concerns me about the money that the government's spending is that, in fact, they could end up just actually being in competition against private first home buyers, for instance. And, you know, we've seen examples that already that the government has been in the market and buying up houses that first home buyers have been trying to get into just earlier this year.
Bridget Morton and Sam Stubbs with us on the weekend panel at 11 minutes to 9. A quick question. Do we need to know why Invercargill Mayor Tim Shadbolt isn't driving his car? Bridget, do you care?
Well, it's complicated because there's two kind of factors. It could be his health, which means I give him, you know, he's allowed to have his privacy about why that may be. If it's a legal matter, then perhaps it does go to, you know, the nature of his job and therefore, you know, maybe we should be aware of it. So it is a little bit difficult here without having any idea about what's going on here to say whether or not he should be disclosing it.
Sam?
Look, not much with Tim Shadbolt is ever simple, is it? So I don't personally need to know, and I don't really think we do need to know. You know, there are laws and regulations here, so I think we should just leave it. But, yeah, what a colourful character.
Invercargill nurse Jenny McGee, the woman who stayed with Boris Johnson in his darkest hours of COVID, is not staying with the National Health Service in the UK. She's off to the Caribbean where the water is warm, but not the beer. And she thought the one-point-something pay offer in Britain was measly and ungrateful for nurses. And locally, our nurses were also similarly disillusioned with the one-point-something pay offer here, although the DHBs say characterising it as being that low is a huge oversimplification. Helen Kemp said this to News Hub.
Initially, we put it down to people being stressed during lockdown, but we're 13, 14 months past that now, and it's
right.
still
that's
happening.
Not, that's not Helen Kemp, but you can probably guess the gist of what she did say to News Hub, basically that nurses can get better opportunities overseas. And I notice in California you can earn more than $100,000 US as a senior nurse. So what do you think our nurses should be paid, and how would we manage that, Bridget?
So I think one of the factors we've got is we've got multiple DHBs and the government is, you know, reforming that. I'm not sure whether one central DHB is going to solve that, but one factor has to be the fact that you don't have a whole lot of sort of DHBs being the employer and wasting a lot of time on, you know, bureaucracy rather than actually on the outcome. The second thing is I think you need to have a mechanism where you're paying really good nurses and recognising the people that are upskill, the people that have really good experience, the people that are going above and beyond, because that's the type of nurses that we really, really want to hold on to. And we don't want a system where everyone's just getting paid the same. So I think it's a bit more complex than just saying it's a 1% or 2% increase. You actually need to make sure that there's merit-based steps in there.
Yeah, which is not the thrust of what the nurses... I haven't been into it in inordinate depth, but it doesn't seem to be the thrust of what the nurses want, the selective pay aspect, does it?
Well, I think, you know, there's a difference between perhaps what the unions are sort of saying and what sort of nurses on the ground. You know, we lose a lot of... you know, good medical professionals across the Tasman, and now with the Trans-Tasman bubble opening, I think that's a real threat. And also, you know, the government's rhetoric, a public service freeze, just sends a really strong signal to nurses, along with, you know, many others, to say, no matter what you do, we're not going to recognise the effort you've put in.
Sam, this is another case of an issue that never seems to be solved, basically. I mean, we have nurses who are absolutely vital people in our society, and other vital people perennially don't seem to be paid quite enough either. How do we better do this?
Yeah, look, I think there's sort of two things spring to mind, Jim. First of all, is I think the debate right now is a function of having a Labor government. You're always going to get the unions will always feel as if they can get more out of a Labor government than a National government. So it's unsurprising that they get more aggressive in these at times like these. But the second thing is with nurses particularly, and I've spent with sick family members, I've spent a lot of time in hospitals in the last 3 years. And the one thing that's very noticeable is there's a huge skills range there, you know. And so just to say nurses, that's a very crude term there. So, and the most senior experienced nurses, to my mind, are more like nurse practitioners in a place like the US or Canada. I think they should be called that. They should be paid and rewarded that way. It's one way that actually takes some pressure off the doctors, which are always in chronically short supply. It also means that you can pay them more because, quite frankly, they're being paid for their skills and they're basically using those skills. And so, you know, you can get top nurses in this country. I understand they can get paid about $130,000. That feels to me right for someone who's that skilled. But you know, there are also, you know, there's a huge range of skills there. I think what we're seeing is quite a lot of political posturing in the public arena. I think privately, there's some sensible heads will work this out. Bearing in mind also the nurses got, is it a 16% pay rise last year?
Yeah, that was pointed out by the DHBs. Yeah. I wonder how many are on that 130Ks figure, because I saw that as well. But that nurse practitioner future is the future you think we're moving towards, basically.
I think we have to, because otherwise you're just going to have to train a lot more of very, very expensive doctors, and they'll be doing things that they don't need to do, so they won't be utilising their skills, and you'll have a whole lot of incredibly experienced nurses there who aren't doing what they're perfectly capable of doing.
Sam and Bridget on the panel, 6 minutes to nine. What sort of immigration do we want in New Zealand now? Here's the Prime Minister.
Our view is that a rebalance is required. We will not be turning off the tap of access to temporary migrant workers in New Zealand. That is not our intent. However, our view is a rebalance is required, given in the last 10 years we've seen significant growth.
And New Zealand's highest in the OECD for the numbers of temporary migrant workers, so the government wants to shift the balance away towards attracting high-skilled migrants. But Bridget, we've heard all this before, haven't we?
Yeah, and we definitely have. And one thing that always concerns me slightly is treating migrants just as some sort of economic input. You know, they're actually people and they bring a lot more to our country than just, you know, what they can do in terms of a job. So I think you need to be really careful sometimes. You know, low-skilled migrants, you know, they may come here, but in terms of, you know, their work ethic and, you know, their family values and all that kind of stuff, you end up with great people that are part of the community that raise great kids and they, you know, go on to do amazing things. So I just want to be, you know, I think we get too caught on, you know, them coming and taking our jobs and, you know, how much money they're going to bring in. But actually we need to think about the kind of multicultural, pluralistic kind of, you know, country that we want to have and what migration does to that kind of society.
And if immigration doesn't drive local wages down, which has been argued about this week, what's not to like, Sam?
Yeah, look, you know, any you know, wonderful functioning modern economy has this constant influx of migrants coming in, right? Makes, you know, go right back to the Saxons and the Normans and see what they did for England, right? So they're always there. I think the government are treading on a delicate nerve here, because if you think about these migrant workers, they're coming over here because they want to work. They're getting the visas because there are people who want to employ them, and they want to employ them because there aren't enough locals to employ. And I think this thing about having the highest number of migrants is in the OECD, it's a little bit disingenuous, because we have an awful lot of seasonal work that requires people, you know, fruit picking and so on. And what we've seen through COVID is we clearly cannot provide that workforce domestically. They've got to come in here. So I'm not sure what the government is trying to achieve here. The reality is we're going to have to bring in a mix of migrants. We've always wanted high-value migrants. What's changed here? Why are we having this debate?
One light topic, one heavy one maybe before we go. We heard from Research New Zealand this morning that about a quarter of Kiwis now feel unsafe on public transport, at sports events and in large gatherings, and 9% was the figure, I think, that even feel unsafe in their own homes. And when Countdown employee Michelle McKenzie, Michelle began to speak before, talked to media about the awful Dunedin stabbing, she said violence and abuse in supermarkets are increasing. But we don't have it now, but we did hear her start to talk about this before. So what is going on in society? I mean, a quick example, I remember the days before swipe cards started being necessary in all workplaces. They just simply weren't flashed and produced. And now there are cameras, and we jump through so many more hoops now, we seem to, in our real and our online lives, to stay safe. Bridget, what's your analysis?
I think, you know, we heard just briefly before about sort of the stress and the pressures of sort of last year. you know, really sort of bringing some things, you know, to head for people. Ultimately, a lot of this is to do with mental health, and we're seeing that, you know, is it a massive issue that is happening in New Zealand. And so I think, you know, this is quite a complex factor that actually goes way back to thinking about what are we doing, you know, for our young people in terms of supporting them in terms of resilience and coping mechanisms and setting that culture at a young age about how they can manage their mental health better so that we don't get to this sort of extreme end of people, you know, feeling like they need to resort to violence or lashing out.
So you're essentially saying it's what? Socioeconomic?
I don't think it's socioeconomic. I think it's actually a lot to do with culture. So, you know, one of the things that we know is that a lot of resilience of people was actually sort of grown in those sort of early years, you know, ages sort of 2 to 5 is where kids actually learn how to manage their emotions a lot, deal with sort of, you know, if they fall over to get themselves up and, you know, brush their knees off. And so you've actually got to have investment way earlier in the sort of, you know, in the policy settings to actually make sure that when the people are sort of coming through and getting through the education system and, you know, hopefully avoiding the justice system, that they're not ending up in this situation where this is the only coping mechanism that they understand.
Okay,
I don't think you want to completely focus on it being an economic issue. It's actually a lot to do with how, what the skills are we're teaching our young people.
Early intervention. All
yeah.
Right. Sam, what's your take on it?
Look, I think to a certain extent it is socioeconomic in the sense. Look, I spend every second week in Wellington, and I flip flop from Auckland to Wellington, and I do a lot of walking around. And the places I walk in seem very safe to me. This seems to be a safer New Zealand for me than when I was a kid. There was just a lot more violence on the field, domestic violence, and so on. But there are also areas in this country where it's clearly not the case, and I suspect that they will be the poorer areas where you get those mental health issues, you get those financial stress issues. I don't personally like a society where we start having swipe cards, security guards, where we start to create a fortress sort of prison-type mentality. I think actually that just makes it worse, not better. I think we have to walk around, get around, and trust each other. I think, you know, very densely populated places tend to be safer places to be. If you've ever lived in a place like Hong Kong, there's just no violence on the streets ever because there are so many people around all the time. So I think this speaks straight to poverty, and if we don't do things about this, we're going to just expect more violence.
All right, and that's all we've got time for. But thank you both for your company on the panel this morning, Sam Stubbs and Bridget Morton.